Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Irina Zhurov.
And I'm Willow Belden. They've been called the secret ingredient of everything. Rare earths are a group of elements that make much of today's technology possible, from smartphones to wind turbines to precision-guided missiles. For decades, China has dominated the rare earth market. But amid questions about the wisdom of allowing one country to control the supply chain, a mining project in Wyoming is getting underway. As Wyoming Public Radio's Stephanie Joyce reports, if the mine opens, it would only be the second one in the United States and the first new one in decades.
The proposed mine would be on federal land just outside of Sundance in northeast Wyoming. Rare Element Resources, or RER, discovered the Bear Lodge deposit in 2004, but it wasn't until China drastically cut exports of rare earths in 2010 and prices skyrocketed that exploration got underway in earnest. But when it did in a big way.
Every day is kind of like Christmas, opening up new boxes, you know? You never know what you're going to see.
That's geologist Joe Monks. He's showing me around one of the massive storage sheds where RER keeps the hundreds of thousands of feet of rock samples they've drilled in recent years. Monks and other geologists are trying to paint a 3D picture of the deposit to understand the mine's potential. It turns out rare earths aren't actually that rare, but it's hard to find concentrated deposits of them that are economically recoverable. Not only that, they're hard to extract from the surrounding rock.
Gold, copper, silver, that's very easy. You know, you dig a bunch of gold ore out of the ground, you throw some cyanide on it, it comes out, no problem. Rare earths are very difficult. They're very similar chemically to each other, so to get them out of the rock is very difficult.
Which means that in addition to the mine, RER will need a processing facility, where they'll use chemicals to isolate and concentrate the rare earths. But because of mineral variation, every deposit has to be processed in a unique way. And Monk says convincing investors that their process works is the company's next hurdle. RER is a small mining company, and the mine and plant will cost at least $400 million.
And to get that money, we have to prove to investors that, yes, this can be done and we can make money on it, and you don't have to pay you back.
If RER can do that, the processing plant will be built on what's currently an unassuming patch of grass on the outskirts of Upton, about 30 miles south of Sundance and the proposed mine.
That area there is where the rare elements would be setting up.
That's Tom Barrett. He's the CEO of Tiger Transfer, which operates the Upton Logistics Center. The logistics center is next to the proposed plant site and has a rail spur, storage facilities, power, and access to natural gas. If the processing plant is built, it would use those services. As he gives me a driving tour, Barrett explains the plant would be good not only for his company, but the entire community.
Small towns like Upton, you have to drag yourself up by the bootstraps to keep going. And these are the things that make that work.
RER says it's already received over 200 resumes from interested residents in Upton and Sundance. But not everyone is so enthusiastic. Benita Carlson is a fifth-generation landowner in Sundance. She's not opposed to the mine, but she's worried that in their excitement, people aren't thinking things through.
Almost maybe are starry-eyed and blinded by the possibilities.
Possibilities that Carlson thinks have been oversold. Politicians have talked about the potential for value-added processing, not just mining the rare earths, but manufacturing the high-tech products they're essential to. Carlson says that's unlikely.
What will leave Upton is dust that needs to be further refined. We can't refine it further here in the U.S.
Carlson isn't wrong. Right now, the United States doesn't have the ability to separate the rare earth concentrate into the individual elements that wind up in smartphones or magnets, although several labs are working on it. That means the minerals will ultimately have to be shipped overseas, possibly even to China. Carlson says that undermines another frequently cited reason to develop the mine, that it's important for national security because of rare earth's role in weapons technology.
That has been part of the big push as far as the community grooming process and, you know, getting community members on board and the community excited about it, you know, and you can really do your part. National security issue, and people need to be allowed to have not just part of the truth, but all of it.
In short, Carlson doesn't want national security and economic development to overshadow the potential environmental and health issues. Rare earth mining ventures in decades past have left a long trail of Superfund sites and costly environmental cleanups. Regulations and understanding of the potential risks have changed a lot since then, but there are plenty of unknowns. Sundance Mayor Paul Brooks says he doesn't let himself worry about those.
I guess I'm pragmatic. I'm not turning my back on the environment. I'm pragmatic enough to understand that this deal's a lot bigger than I am, and I just need to be ready for it. I can't stop it. I can't endorse it. I can't do anything. I have to be ready for it, and that's where I'm at.
The city has already started to prepare, updating its zoning and investing in a designated industrial area outside of town. Brooks says that's as much as he can do to minimize any negative impacts.
You know, it's sad to me when you drive across Wyoming and you see the impact of lack of planning on these towns. Here's a beautiful setting and you got a crane sitting in the middle of the town, and I just don't think we want that.
It's a balancing act, though. Brooks says if the mine doesn't happen, the planning will have been for naught. But if it does, it will be good to have thought things through in advance. Either way, the earliest the mine could open is 2017. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Several years ago, there were days when air pollution in Pinedale was worse than in Los Angeles. Residents complained of respiratory problems and visits to local medical clinics increased. In 2012, the Environmental Protection Agency said the area was violating federal air quality standards and gave Wyoming 3 years to fix the problem. Since then, air quality has been better. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports, nobody knows whether the problem is really fixed. And some worry that the state is not doing enough to prevent similar problems from happening elsewhere.
The pollution in question is called ground-level ozone. It forms when different sorts of emissions, in this case from energy development, react with each other under certain weather conditions. To address the problem, the state started requiring new production facilities to have special technology that cuts down on emissions. Some operators also have taken voluntary steps to pollute less, for example, by retrofitting older equipment. Steve Dietrich with the Wyoming Department of Environmental Quality says it's helped.
This winter ozone season, there have not been any exceedances of the 8-hour ozone standard.
In other words, there haven't been any days where ozone levels went above the legal limit. The same was true last winter.
I think it's good news.
That's Rob Field. He's an atmospheric scientist at UW, and he's been studying ozone in Sublette County for several years. He says recently he's been detecting much lower levels of certain types of pollutants in the air. That's partly because of DEQ's new rules and partly because there's simply less new development in the area.
So while we still have a lot of oil and natural gas produced, we see less drilling rigs. Back in 2011, we had 15 or maybe more drill rigs. This last year, maybe down to 5.
And that means a reduction in emissions. But does it mean that the ozone problem is fixed?
I don't think we can say that yet.
That's because emissions are only part of the puzzle. A lot also depends on weather. Several years ago, when ozone levels were high, nighttime temperatures were very cold. That created conditions that trapped the pollution in the area, which contributed to higher ozone levels. Recently, it's been warmer.
Would I expect there to be ozone next year? If we see these meteorological conditions and we continue to see less activity and good emission control, maybe we won't see ozone next year. But again, it's a guess at this point. We just have to keep measuring and keep watching the system to see how it changes in the future.
Scientists still don't have an exact recipe of ingredients and weather conditions that have to come together in order for high levels of ozone to form. Because of that uncertainty, the Department of Environmental Quality is planning to do even more to curb emissions. They're drafting new rules that would require greener retrofits for old energy facilities. In other words, facilities that were put in when the rules were more lax. Bruce Pendry with the Wyoming Outdoor Council says that's good, but he wants to see the state prevent rather than just respond to ozone pollution. The new rules will only apply in the Sublette County area, where ozone problems have already been documented. Energy equipment elsewhere in the state will still be allowed to pollute just as much as in the past.
They should consider extending regulations to more of a statewide basis. If oil and gas could cause air pollution problems in the Pinedale area when they were having a boom over there, maybe we're going to see the same thing in other places if we're not, you know, out in front of it a little bit.
But Steve Dietrich with DEQ says there are no plans to impose Pinedale-style regulations on the whole state anytime soon. That would mean an extra cost for operators.
There may not actually be a problem in other parts of the state, so to put the industry and put everything at risk by ratcheting down to the nth degree may not make good economic sense to do that.
Dietrich says if they detect high levels of pollution elsewhere, they'll deal with the problem then. As for Pinedale, they'll keep monitoring air quality, and if ozone levels stay low next winter, EPA could consider lifting the non-attainment designation. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
When we come back, we'll hear the latest from State Superintendent Cindy Hill and about silicosis in the oil and gas industry. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Irina Zhorov.
And I'm Willow Belden. It's been called miner's phthisis, grinder's asthma, potter's rot. Silicosis is a disease of the lungs that's caused by inhaling tiny particles of crystalline silica dust, basically sand. Those particles cut the lung tissue, causing inflammation and scarring that make it difficult to breathe. The disease is nothing new. The ancient Greeks were the first to give it a name. But concern about it is cropping up in new places, including the oil and gas industry. Wyoming Public Radio's energy and natural resources reporter Stephanie Joyce joins us to talk about the problem and what's being done about it. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Willow.
So why is this a problem in the oil and gas industry?
Well, Willow, as most people here in Wyoming know, oil and gas wells these days are often completed using a technique that's known as hydraulic fracturing or fracking. And that technique involves pumping huge volumes of water and sand into the wellbore at high pressures to create tiny cracks or fractures in the rock. And so that means having millions of pounds of sand on hand at well sites. And if that sand isn't properly managed, it becomes airborne and workers breathe it in, hence silicosis. And a 2012 study by the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health found that at more than half of sampled well sites, exposure levels were above mandated workplace safety standards. At some well sites, exposure levels were 10 times higher. And that's an important detail because even short-term exposures at that level can cause silicosis.
How widespread is this problem? I mean, is this at every well site, some well sites?
Well, the short answer is that no one really knows. The government thinks it's pretty widespread, though. The NIOSH study only sampled 11 sites, but they felt the results were representative enough to issue an industry-wide hazard alert, advising all companies of the danger. And right now, there are roughly 500,000 oil and gas workers in the U.S. Almost half of those work at well servicing companies, the companies that actually frack wells. So there's a lot of potential for exposure, but not a lot of data on actual exposure. Something to keep in mind, though, is that drilling is on the upswing. I recently spoke with Dan Neal of the Equality State Policy Center about the issue, which he's been following closely. Let me play you a little bit of what he had to say about it.
We're looking at somewhere between 25,000 to 30,000 wells being drilled in Wyoming in the next 10 to 15 years. Most of those wells, if not the wide majority of those wells, will be fracked. And we know that companies will be using sand in most instances.
And Willow, that last point that Neil makes is important because there is some work being done on using sand alternatives. When this issue has come up in the past, the Petroleum Association of Wyoming has mentioned that one way that it's looking at dealing with the issue and keeping workers safe is looking into some of those alternatives.
What else is being done to address the problem?
Well, the first thing was that hazard bulletin that I mentioned before. The government sent that out to employers across the country to let them know about the issue. NIOSH has also put out some suggestions for cheap, easy-to-implement technologies that would help keep the dust under control. And they're developing some additional, more complicated technologies. In the fall, I spoke with Eric Eswin, who was one of the leaders on the study that uncovered this problem. And he said one of the bigger challenges is getting access to some of the contractors that need help the most.
We've had smaller companies call us up and ask for our help, but of course, you know, they can't necessarily get us onto the site because our presence on the site is going to have to be essentially approved by the operator.
The operators being the big name companies that you've probably heard of. That said, Eswin also mentioned that some of those operators have approached NIOSH for help. And some of them have started investing quite a bit of money, you know, tens of millions of dollars in technology to help with the problem. So that's going on. And then at the state level, OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, is working on some of its own outreach. But while we're on the topic of challenges, another one is that there's a lot of turnover in the oil and gas industry. Workers move jobs pretty regularly, so it can be hard to make sure that they're getting the information. And it's not like it's exactly intuitive. You know, most people don't automatically think, hey, sand, I wonder if that's a health hazard. You know, so compounding that also is the fact that OSHA doesn't conduct a huge number of site inspections annually. So if an employer isn't dealing with a problem on its own, it might be going undetected.
You mentioned sand. Obviously, it's not just in the oil and gas industry that workers interact with sand. So how big is the problem in the oil and gas industry relative to other industries?
That's a really good question. You're definitely right that it's not just in the oil and gas industry where silica exposure is a problem. Construction and mining are traditionally the industries that people worry about. And between the two of those, there are many, many, many more workers than oil and gas. But it's kind of hard to compare them because concerns in the oil and gas industry are a little different. It's still a very new problem and exposure levels are somewhat unknown. But there is actually an effort underway to reduce acceptable exposure levels across all industries. The current limits were set about 40 years ago, and the Federal Occupational Safety and Health Administration says they're inadequate. The proposed rules also make changes to how silica exposure is monitored, and they guarantee medical exams for workers in high-risk positions. But that proposal has received quite a bit of pushback from industry pretty much across the board. There were hearings held in Washington, D.C. in March and the beginning of April, and hundreds of groups testified. The American Petroleum Institute was one of them. In written testimony, API's senior economist raised issues about the cost, saying the proposed rules would be devastating to small operators. And a lobbyist for API raised questions about feasibility, saying the technologies currently available to control dust can't get exposure levels down to what's proposed. So OSHA will have to respond to those comments, and we'll just see where things go from there. Previous efforts to change the acceptable exposure levels have failed, and it's not clear that they'll be any more successful this time.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing more as things progress. Thanks, Stephanie.
Thanks, Willow.
That was Wyoming Public Radio energy and natural resources reporter Stephanie Joyce speaking about silicosis in the oil and gas industry.
State Superintendent of Public Instruction Cindy Hill will soon be returning to lead the Wyoming Department of Education. Unless you've been under a rock, you know that the superintendent had her ability to oversee the department removed by the legislature and the governor last year. The Supreme Court restored that power, and legal and other negotiations are currently underway to restore her powers. As she waits her next move, Superintendent Hill agreed to tape an interview with Bob Beck about what will happen when she returns to office and what she thinks of some current controversy concerning state standards.
If it's me and I'm in your position, I might have some hard feelings towards people as you walk back into that position. How do you go back and get things, I guess, normalized?
I don't have any hard feelings. I think it's important for us to realize that the people in the department are just doing their work, and they're working hard, and they're focused on, hopefully focused on the children of the state and the will of the people, which is that we educate them optimally. So I think they're working hard, and I think that a few have been distracted. I would agree with that, but I'd like to think that we all would be focused when I entered. That's very clear that that's what's needed.
I think there are people that are a little worried about you go in there and you get rid of any of your opponents.
I didn't do that when I walked in the first time. So you can look at my actions. I entered the department. There were 158 employees. 156 were essentially tenured. They're called permanent employees. They're like tenured teachers. And of 156, I fired one, and it's because he couldn't come to work. Recently, he was the reason he couldn't come to work is that he had been allegedly had done some harm, actually killed two people, and shot the third one also in the head. And what happened, Bob, is that he was convicted all three counts, and so he couldn't come to work. But that's the truth. Of 156 employees that I walked into, I fired one. You just have to look at a person's actions to know what they'll do.
State Superintendent Cindy Hill visiting with us. Would you anticipate your goals will be a lot different when you retake over the position?
When I entered, and as the people elected me to do, we focused on instruction, and that's what matters. That which is the student and the parent and the teacher, that's what makes a difference in the life of the student. Whether or not we have standards, we always have targets, and again, assessments, measuring those standards, those matter, but not nearly as important as the instructional practices inside the classroom. So that was my focus when I came in, that focus and that promise that we'd focus on the instruction. We did that. Scores statewide in every subject matter tested, in every grade level tested, rose, that increased, and that hadn't happened for years, and it happened both years that I was in the Department of Education. We can be distracted by, again, the politic that's going on, those things that don't really matter to kids. That's what's been most disturbing to me, is that some of these things that have been taking place and have been distracting the people at the Wyoming Department of Ed, people confusing those in our districts, are really not about kids. We need to get back and get focused. We need our standards to be clear for our districts and for our kids and for our communities. We need our assessments to be clear, and we need the people and all those who have a stake in all of this to be actively participating in this.
One of the things that's going on, in fact, is this ERS. This is when the State Board of Education, again, is talking about some standards issues. You've been part of those discussions and have watched them. I don't think I'm wrong in saying you're not a huge fan of Common Core. We'll get to that in a second. But as you look at where they're headed with standards, good thing, bad thing, do you have any concerns out there?
Well, I do have concerns. We're going to spend the money of the people. We really need to think about what is in the best interest of the people, and would I be spending my money this way? And when we look at the State Board of Education, right now we're without a focus. We're having a great deal of struggle over important issues, and I believe that we're not being sensitive to the cost, not just in dollars, but the cost to the confusion of our districts. So I ask a lot of questions of those who are on the board, and I would say that I'm really unsatisfied with where we're going right now. I think there's a lot of politic involved, great deal of unrest, and I don't see it getting better.
What would you like to see with standards if you could wave the magic wand?
We have a number of citizens in this state who would like to participate in the standards and the decision making, not just with standards but also our assessments. And those citizens, I felt that they have not had a voice. We need the highest standards in Wyoming, and we need to ensure that our citizens and our educators and all of those who have a stake in this are participating in the process. And some would say, oh, they have. And I would say some of them haven't felt that. And so we need to make certain that we ensure that those who have questions or concerns, that their voices are being heard. Again, you know, you'll hear we need to compete with all the other states. Well, if we want to be number one, we need to have the highest standards of all.
And you think they're falling short of that?
I think that there are significant gaps. I know that we clearly articulated those in the beginning. We know that there are challenges with the Common Core. There are gaps and there are deficiencies. And we could have done a much better job. But again, that wasn't what was going to take place here. Federalizing education, centralizing what was going on was in place, and that train was moving along long before I even stepped through the door, Bob. Then there's another component, teachers being evaluated on how well their students perform on these tests. That means teachers keeping their jobs dependent upon how well their students are performing on these tests they're measuring the Common Core. And I disagree with all of them.
Would it be your position, because I've heard other people say this in the past, that it would be better to craft our own standards instead of taking federal standards?
I believe we should have the highest, and I don't think the federal standards are the highest.
Can I ask your opinion on this controversy over the science standards? What do you make of that?
Well, I think there are several issues. Why wouldn't we have our standards, again, mirror our values in Wyoming? And why wouldn't they be the highest again? Why would we, again, take from the outside of the state their values, their standards, and make them ours? Why wouldn't we have our own?
Should climate change be part of our standards?
Well, I would say to you, Bob, that we need to have that discussion in Wyoming, and we haven't. We've taken someone else's standards from outside the state, and we've said, this is the answer. These are the best standards. This is what we believe. And we haven't had that discussion in Wyoming where the stakeholders have come together and made sure, and all those who feel like they've been left out, that their voices have been heard so that we can have a really hearty discussion about what we do believe in Wyoming. So I think we should do the work, Bob, and we haven't done it yet.
State Superintendent Cindy Hill, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
When we come back, we'll have an interview with UW President Dick McGinnity, a story about UW's new literacy center, and a piece on court translators in the state. This is Open Spaces.
Superintendent Hill also told Bob Beck that she will continue her plans to run against Governor Meade and confirm that she has no plans to run for re-election for superintendent.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Irina Zhorov. University of Wyoming President Dick McGinnity wrapped up his first legislative session last month, and he calls it quite a learning experience. He joins Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck to review the session.
All I would say is the governor and the legislature demonstrated once again the deep support they have for the university, the legislature as a whole, and individuals within it. We did not do as well on compensation as I would have wished, but this is only inning one of at least a nine-inning game. And so we'll be going back to the legislature. Well, as most of the listeners will know, there is a supplemental budget session about a year from now. And so even though the legislature addressed the biennium from a compensation standpoint, that does not preclude the university from going back in the supplemental session with identification of some additional needs that may come up between now and then with respect to how we might like more funding. In connection with the funding, the legislature granted a pool of money for the university as it did for other state agencies. And so we're in process of developing the rules for distributing that, but also, again, taking a look at next year.
I want to come back to that in just a second, but okay. I do want to ask you this. As we were doing our closing interviews and that sort of thing, one of the interviews I did was with the Speaker of the House, Tom Lubnow, and he made an interesting statement about the university that I have had other lawmakers talk to me about, and they've had some I don't know if distress is the right word or concern that the communication between UW and them has not been great. And maybe it's actually, who knows, led to some setbacks from the university as you look for salary increases and that sort of thing. I wonder if they've shared that with you, if you're taking that to heart and you think that can be corrected.
excuse me. I have heard that from them, and I will not go into the whys or the wherefores of it, but I have heard it from many. And as you've heard the cliche, perception is reality. And whatever the bases of their feelings about it are, if that is their perception, that is what we have to deal with. One of the reasons I was over there at the legislature as much as I was during the session was just to find out where that comes from and mm-hmm. to figure out how we can interact better with the legislature. But going more broadly than that, we do need to figure out how to communicate more effectively with any number of constituencies across the state. So, for example, I was in Green River and Rock Springs yesterday talking with a number of educators and also with the president of the of Western Wyoming Community College on how we can work together better. And I think the more of that we do, and the more responsive we appear to be to those groups, that will feed back to their legislators. And so to the extent that there may be a problem at the moment, I intend that it be addressed very energetically in the coming year.
If you look at their footnotes and you look at some of the amendments and that sort of thing, it would have made my head spin if, I can handle when my boss tells me to do five or six things. I think you said somewhere along the line there was 40-some amendments or footnotes in there to address, and I'm certainly not going to ask you to break them all down because I'm sure you could remember seven like I could. But it does – there's the other side of this. There are people that might view that as a micromanaging situation. How do you get it from being that and so it's a good compromise and a good discussion where we're moving forward?
Yeah, good question. And I see that as an opportunity. And you don't have to be blind to see the opportunities. I mean, in some cases they say, well, if we were willing to do X for you, how would you do it? And will you give us a plan for saying what you would do that? That is not a problem. That's a real interesting opportunity. And the science lab's proposal is related to that. But at the same time, there are different – the legislature consists of 90 different individuals, and every one of them, whether they're pro or con the university, they have interests in different aspects of the university's operations. Some of them may tend to be critical, some less so. Some may feel as though it's reasonable to ask for pretty detailed operating information that might seem intrusive. But on the other hand, there is an abundance of information available about the university in places that are not easily findable. We're going to make them more easily findable over the course of the coming year. Arlie Williams in the Vice President's Office, Administration and Finance, operates what is a national award-winning dashboard that lays out a lot of information about the university, and we're going to refine that and make it more easily findable and accessible. So there are a number of things we can do to respond to the university, and I don't consider it intrusive. I see it as an opportunity to build relationships and make this institution more understandable to them.
University of Wyoming President Dick McGinnity, a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Rob. Good to be here.
Wyoming is a largely rural state with limited diversity. But as the population grows and the state attracts all sorts of newcomers, Wyoming is learning to accommodate the changing population. One of the areas where the state is making headway is interpretation services in its courts. Wyoming Public Radio's Irina Zhorov reports.
Last spring, an acupuncturist in Cheyenne was arrested after patients accused him of sexual assault. He was eventually found not guilty. The acupuncturist is an American citizen, but his command of English is limited. His first language is Mandarin Chinese, and his experience with the justice system was often frustrating. For example, public defender Melody Anchieta says police officers questioned him without a translator before arresting him, something that's technically legal, but arguably poor practice.
I went to see him when he was in the jail, and I could tell, I could communicate well enough to let him know that I was his attorney, I would be there with him in court, but we all immediately started looking for a Mandarin interpreter, which isn't very easy to find in Wyoming.
At his preliminary hearing, there was a translator from Colorado who translated by phone. Phone translation is used often when an interpreter can't be in the courtroom, but Anchieta says it's not ideal.
Never occurred to me we would need a Mandarin interpreter in Cheyenne.
She eventually found one in Fort Collins, and the woman came to Cheyenne a handful of times to help Anchieta and the acupuncturist communicate. Later at the trial, the court provided other interpreters, but even then there were issues. For example, the Cheyenne Circuit Court didn't have proper equipment, which consists of an earpiece for the client and a small mic for the translator. Instead, they'd have to just stand close and whisper into the client's ear. Sarah Pfefferly is a Spanish translator in Cheyenne. She says this has been a problem for a long time.
It has always been frustrating to me to hang on a defendant's shoulder. It's a very close proximity. It's not very professional. So that I can reach their ear, so that I can be unobtrusive and invisible, and nothing more than a vehicle in the process between the judge and the person appearing in the court.
The court finally acquired a sound system for the acupuncturist trial. After Anchieta told the court reporter she'd seen such equipment used in her previous job in Kansas City. Pfefferle says another good step has been the establishment of pay scale policies for translators working for the justice system. For the past few years, translators have been able to earn higher fees by passing tests and earning certifications. Pfefferle says that's important.
I don't work full time. I don't get benefits. I pay my own employment taxes. The work is spotty.
Spotty work is perhaps the biggest obstacle, says Christy Racines, who runs the state's two-year-old court interpreter program. It was established to improve the quality and availability of interpreters in state courts.
As a court interpreter, even if you're in Cheyenne or Laramie, you know, some of the larger, busier courts, you can't make a living doing it. So it is something that could maybe supplement another income or maybe good for someone who is retired or works from home. But it is difficult to attract people to this career because at this point there's really not enough work to employ full-time interpreters.
Jackson has a large population of Spanish speakers, and so the circuit court there does maintain a Spanish interpreter on staff. But it's the only court in the state to do so. Otherwise, the courts rely on contractors. Racina says right now there are 16 interpreters on the court's roster that can be called upon an as-needed basis, but they're all Spanish translators. The federal court's roster in Wyoming is also exclusively Spanish translators. Racina says there's a reason for that. Other languages just aren't needed as much.
I mean, we may need a Mandarin interpreter once or twice in the entire state per year.
Cheyenne has seen the need for Somali interpreters increase somewhat, and then there's been a random case here and there requiring a Laotian interpreter, for example. But Racina says her office is still trying to be proactive. Last year, they hosted orientations around the state to distribute information about the translation program and try to get interpreters on the roster for potential use in the future. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Irina Zhorov.
Last month, the University of Wyoming opened a literacy research center and clinic that should enhance literacy at all levels across the state. It will allow face-to-face tutoring, train tutors and teachers, and use technology in interesting new ways. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports.
I see this as being on the cutting edge of work in literacy, K-12 and beyond.
That's Vicki Gillis, who shares co-director duties of the facility that will focus on family literacy, early childhood literacy, disciplinary literacies, and tutoring of struggling readers. The center will do its share of its own tutoring, but the bigger charge is to train others to do the same thing. They can perform this training in a variety of ways, but it'll mostly be done through the use of technology. Gillis says that includes cameras in classrooms outside of Laramie and web-based systems, among other things.
We will actually be able to view a classroom as the teacher's teaching, and then give that teacher some feedback immediately.
Under Common Core and similar standards, students are now required to demonstrate their understanding of a topic by articulating what they are learning. That means teachers are teaching differently too. Co-director George Camborella says this is something many teachers are struggling with.
The standards require kids' understanding of disciplinary literacy, so how to read and write strategically in those different subject areas. And that's something that teachers in those subject areas and English teachers really have never had to face in the past.
Camborella says this should not only improve a student's performance, but also make for more effective teaching. The same technology can be used to observe and react to a tutoring session as well. Another focus will be on the literacy for young children inside the home and at school. Becca Steinhoff of the organization Wyoming Kids First says the center will be able to provide important research and training in that arena.
Really lending credibility, vision, recognition to the fact that children's social and cultural experiences inside and outside of the home environment during those first 5 years of life greatly enhance their literacy skills and then their formal school experience.
Steinhoff says that a lot of organizations around the state don't have access or resources for feedback and training. She says the Literacy Center will change that.
all corners of the state are going to be able to think about literacy and really have a challenged dialogue from wherever they are, and access to a set of resources that we know looks at evidence-based practices and high-level research that in the past hasn't been available.
Steinhoff thinks the Literacy Center could be a game changer for improved literacy in the state. In Jackson, the Teton Literacy Center has been focused on the topic for many years, but Executive Director Shan Kingston says the UW Literacy Center has already helped her staff get important training on some areas that they've not focused on.
We use Skype sessions. They are able to research issues that are specific to us and provide us or direct us to resources that we might not be able to obtain on our own through access to their libraries and databases, and to guide us to the solutions that we need for our very specific issues.
Kingston agrees with Steinhoff that few towns would have access to the kind of resources the University of Wyoming will now be able to provide. But there is cost, and she does hope that the outreach component of the program takes into account the budget limitations some organizations might face. As mentioned earlier, school districts are also interested in the program. For instance, Camarella says that he's been approached to help with struggling schools. Sheridan County District 2 Superintendent Craig Doherty says he's been talking to the university about improving its outreach effort, and he says the Literacy Center is a great way to step that up.
There are not programs, but models of professional development that teachers should be exposed to so that they can identify kids that need help in reading and have a teacher that has the skill sets to be able to identify what the problems are and to address those.
Doherty says it's about developing great teachers. Camarella says he is not aware of another center around the country that's ever attempted to take on the outreach efforts that the Literacy Center is attempting. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
When we come back, we'll hear from an author who's made it his mission to promote dark skies, explain the importance of seeing stars. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Willow Belden.
And I'm Irina Zhorov. An exhibit opening this weekend at the University of Wyoming Art Museum is among the first major displays of astrophotography as art. Starstruck, the Fine Art of Astrophotography, is a dazzling exhibition, ranging from night skies and landscapes to deep space photography. Of course, to see and photograph the stars takes a dark sky, something that's endangered in the modern world. Astronomer and artist Tyler Nordgren is a night sky ambassador and the author of Stars Above, Earth Below, A Guide to Astronomy in the National Parks. Nordgren spoke with Wyoming Public Radio's Micah Schweitzer about why seeing the stars matters.
Up until about 200 years ago, a star-filled sky is something that everyone had experience with. It was there every single night of the year, all year long. And it's only really been these last 100, 200 years that we've fundamentally changed this world in which we live by getting rid of night.
So light pollution is the reason that so many of us cannot see the Milky Way anymore. How do we limit light pollution?
The important thing to get across here is I'm not advocating that we get rid of lights, that we go back to the Stone Age, that we'll all be happier if we live, you know, a paleo lighting environment. No, what I'm really talking about is it's important to put light where we need it, when we need it, in the amounts that we need. Have the light just shine downwards onto the street, downwards onto your property. It's when we put giant globe lights or things that shine light straight up into the sky, it may look kind of nice, but that light's doing nothing useful, and you're paying for the electricity.
And this is an energy issue as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the things that I share with folks is that a typical light bulb that shines light in all directions, that half of the light that's produced that shines above the horizon does nothing useful for you, but you're paying for that electricity. So imagine if you and your town could replace all those lights so the light simply goes downward where you need it to be safe. You could cut your electric bill for your town in half, and you get the stars back.
A lot of your work has to do with the national parks and the night sky there, and you've started sort of a poster campaign that says half the park is after dark.
Right. So one of the things that we've realized, that the Park Service has realized, is that people go to the national parks to see the stars because they can't see them at home anymore. Current estimates are roughly 60% of U.S. and European populations can no longer even faintly see the Milky Way from where they live. So when people come out to the national parks, when they come out to places like Wyoming, suddenly they see what they've been missing all these years. So what we're trying to do is to really advertise that, to make this a tourist draw, and therefore it can actually help communities out here and around the parks. It can be one more reason to bring tourist dollars here. And so just like the WPA program back in the 1930s had this poster campaign to see America, today we're doing a similar one that's See the Milky Way, and to say half the park is after dark.
And you can see the Milky Way from Yellowstone and Natural Bridges and all these different parks.
They're some of the best places to do it. Parks that are beautiful by day are equally beautiful by night.
Are they under threat of light pollution?
Sadly, they are. Communities that are around that are interested in tourists have big hotels, great big signs, the McDonald's with the lights on all night long. And so they actually are threatening these night skies.
And you've taken lots of photos after dark in the parks, and some of them are in your book, The Stars Above, Earth Below, A Guide to Astronomy in the National Parks. And these photos, they almost don't look real. I mean, they're so vivid. They look like space telescope photos. When people see these photographs of yours, what kinds of reactions do you get?
There are certain photos that when I put up on the screen, I can hear people gasp. I hear, oh, and wow. And then I have people ask me, well, that can't be real. You must have digitally put a couple pictures together. Is that right? And I have to say, no. What I'm capturing here is what you can actually see for yourself. And that's been my number one goal. And when I was writing the book, in fact, each chapter ends with a see for yourself section, because I do want people to know this is what you will see. If you come out to the park and give your eyes the half an hour it needs to really open up and adjust to the darkness, you will see more than you have ever seen before.
Those reactions must speak to the fact that we do not see the sky anymore as it really is.
Exactly. We've completely divorced ourselves from this natural nocturnal world. Where I teach right now, I teach in the University of Redlands in the outskirts of Los Angeles. And on a summer evening, especially when the smog has blown in, you can look up in the sky and you can count all 12 stars. And when you can only see 12 stars, there's no reason for you to ever look up. And if you don't look up, the world ends at the horizon as far as you're concerned. And so one of the things I'm also trying to let folks know about is the stars have had a real driving influence on science throughout our history. Almost every scientist I know was impacted by a star-filled sky or something in their past like that. And so if we never even bother to look up, if children never even think to look at the sky, we're in serious danger of losing this next generation of curious potential scientists.
Because it's this, you're looking into something so much vaster than the human experience.
You're looking into deep space and deep time when you go out and look into a star-filled sky. You can't help but wonder, what is that? What are those stars? Is there anything else out there? You know, what does it all mean? Isn't this universe larger than myself or larger than the problems I'm having right now? And you want to know about it. There's both a scientific need, but there's also a spiritual need when you look up at a star-filled sky. And we are taking all of that away. We're in danger of losing it. So when you come to a place like Wyoming where we still have it, that makes it much more important to preserve.
And so you talk about preserving the night sky the way some people might talk about preserving a forest or a lake.
Exactly. Because both of them give you this sort of sense of natural wonder and beauty, a place to go and get in touch with the world in which we live. And when people say, well, hey, there's Hubble Space Telescope pictures of stars, why do you need to see one? It's the same reason I say, well, there are pictures of trees. Why do you really need to see one?
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Mike Schweitzer speaking with astronomer and artist Tyler Nordgren.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates and less important information, you can follow us on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.